The Crown Publishing Group gets a makeover, but how extreme? PW's Rachel Deal gets the inside story from the makeover artist herself. And in reviews, we hear about an informative and engaging look at what's gone wrong in America's downtowns, with the crimes committed by architects and bureaucrats, not thugs and gangsters. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week, Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for an early look at the news that publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will talk about when they get back to work on Monday. Joining me first on the show is Andrew Albanese, PW's Features Editor. Andrew, welcome to Beyond the Book.
Hello, Chris.
Well, here we are. It's the height of the summer reading season, and we talk about people talking about these stories when they get back to work, or they might not get back to work because they might be on vacation. Indeed, we're going to take a little vacation from podcasting for the next couple of weeks, but it is still summer reading time, and appropriately for Monday's issue, Nancy Pearl, who certainly knows her books, has a few picks for these last few weeks.
Yeah, that's right. In Monday's issue, Nancy Pearl is taking a look at seasonal marketing, you know, beach reads, fireplace books, that kind of thing. And she comes up with a few really wonderful picks for the final few weeks of summer, you know, when book lovers everywhere are trying to get in those final few days of beach time. So if you're looking for a great recommendation, you'll definitely want to check out Nancy Pearl's Check It Out column in Monday's edition. And as you mentioned, while you've got that issue of PW in your hand, you should also dive into Rachel Deal's lead story on the reorganization of Random House's Crown Publishing Group. You know, industry watchers will recall that when CEO Marcus Dulé got to Random House, he began reorganizing a number of the company's divisions, including Crown, which has long been known as a kind of as a big, somewhat confusing editorial division with a lot of imprints and, you know, perhaps not enough editorial focus. Well, the big change they made at Crown, of course, was hiring Maya Mavji from Doubleday Canada as publisher and then getting Molly Stern from Viking to oversee the general trade program. In this piece, Rachel gets into some of the structural shifts that have been implemented, but I think more importantly, this is the first time Mavji has really talked to the press about what's gone on at Crown. So this story is very interesting, and industry watchers will definitely want to take a look.
Right. Well, you know, as we said, it's summer reading season, but we know what summer reading has been for Andrew Albanese this season. It's been legal documents, and once again, there are developments in a number of the cases you track for us, including the Apple price-fixing case.
Yeah, you know, it seems like it's a never-ending torrent, and this was quite a week for publishing industry lawyers, shall we say, and also sleep-deprived reporters with newborns at home, like me. You know, you mentioned Apple, so we should get right to that. This week, Apple, along with the two non-settling publishers, Penguin and Macmillan, filed briefs opposing the Department of Justice's proposed settlement with three other publishers, Simon & Schuster, Hachette, and HarperCollins. Now, mercifully, in that case, Judge Cote limited these submissions to 5 pages. So the briefs were actually quite digestible, and I would actually urge readers to check them out themselves online. You can find them in a number of places, including Justia.com. In essence, all of the opposing parties urged the court not to approve the settlement, no shocker there, until the parties had a chance to at least disprove the government allegations in court. Now, Apple has an especially strong case here because it has contracts that actually stand to be voided by this settlement agreement, even though it's never had a chance to prove its innocence. You know, as for the publishers, the non-settling publishers, Macmillan and Penguin, we know how they felt from the beginning. They filed briefs earlier this year detailing their positions, and, you know, hey, they're fighting these charges. But they also, in their briefs, their little 5-page nuggets reminded us of what their strategy is going to be. They are very much going to put Amazon on trial. So you want to pay attention to the PW website next week because the government's response to these briefs is due on the 22nd, and we'll definitely be following up with that. And I have to say, Chris, too, you know, as an industry reporter, you are probably familiar, as am I, with the way publishers fear talking about Amazon. You know, you ask a question about Amazon, and a publisher will look over both shoulders like they're about to tell you a dirty limerick, and then they'll say no comment. Well, that never speak ill of Amazon facade does not apply to a court fight. And after all the years, you know, we've all spent listening to publishers hedge on their feelings about Amazon, well, it sure seems like their feelings are about to become known, and I might add, under oath.
Well, you know, you make a remarkable point there, Andrew. It really is drawing back the curtain, airing dirty laundry, doing all of those things. And it's going to have a lasting impact, whatever the outcome of the case itself.
Indeed.
And there's also a development in the Google case, a minor one, you think, but still, it kind of keeps us guessing as to what's going to happen next.
Yes, Google, the gift that keeps on giving for reporters like me. So a minor development this week that actually kind of seemed rather major. This week, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals agreed to hear Google's appeal of Judge Denny Chin's decision to certify the case as a class action. Now, contrary to some media reports that seem to have been picked up everywhere, this really isn't terribly big news. And a few of the reports out there were kind of misleading. So let's take a minute to sort of correct them and say what's really going on here. First of all, as of now, the case is not going to be suspended as the appeal makes its way through the Second Circuit. A lot of reports suggested that this was almost certain to happen. In fact, yesterday, Judge Chin issued a scheduling order that held that the current schedule is going to be upheld with no changes. So we are expecting opposition briefs in this case to be filed next week as scheduled. Now, remember, this is an appeal on a standing issue. It really has nothing to do with the merits of this case. So there really isn't any reason that this case would have to be suspended at this point. You may as well go ahead and get it fully briefed. It doesn't really change the case much. Still, a stay could happen. The parties might ask for it. Chin might decide he wants it. It could happen, but it really does seem unlikely at this point. So full steam ahead. Second, if the Second Circuit does reverse Chin on the class action issue, it doesn't end the case. A lot of reports said that it would effectively end the case. That's not true. The case would proceed. It would simply proceed on the basis of three named plaintiffs rather than as a class action. Now, that certainly is a tougher road in terms of financing the case for the Authors Guild, but it doesn't end the case, and it doesn't even really change it substantially on the merits. It's still a fair use case, whether it's a class action or, you know, a case on based on the three named plaintiffs. But the risk of proceeding for the Authors Guild would certainly grow. If it wasn't a class action, they'd have less opportunity to recover damages, for example, and they'd be on the hook if they lost, potentially, for paying Google's legal fees, which, you know, obviously are pretty considerable at this point. And the last and third thing is that the case was, a lot of people have said that the case was bound to wind up on appeal anyway. And that's true. The case is bound to wind up on appeal, and it still is. This is a standing issue appeal. I'll say it again. And regardless of how this appeal falls, if the case goes through a trial and then a verdict, that verdict too is likely to be appealed on the merits. So this is not the appeal. This is one appeal. And last, it was noted that Chin, who is a member of the Second Circuit, now recused himself from this appeal. And the reports were that this would now only be heard by a panel of two judges at the Second Circuit. And that's not the case. There are 13 active judges on the Second Circuit. They're going to pick a panel of three to hear this appeal. And that matters because if it was only two judges and those judges split, then that would uphold Chin's class certification. But we are going to have three judges on the panel, unless for some reason the three judges start hearing the case and then one of them has to recuse themselves. Unlikely. So long story short, Google will have an appeal heard at the Second Circuit, but not the appeal that we're all waiting for, and the case continues. So check out pwnextweek.com for even more developments.
Well, I feel a Riddler moment coming on here. When is an appeal not an appeal? But I won't go there. Listen, it is still summer. We said these are the final weeks of summer. We're about to take our break, and we do hope you get a chance to read something other than legal briefs, Andrew. So tell us, what's on your bedside table or you're bringing down with you to the beach?
I thought you'd never ask. And I know Rose will highlight a couple of books too, probably. So yes, I do have a few great things to read. You know, as you know, Chris, I'm really into music and I'm loving a book right now by Jesse Jarno on one of my favorite bands, New Jersey's own Yola Tango. The book is called Big Day Coming. I'm also enjoying a book on a not very enjoyable topic by journalist Denver Nix. It's a book about Private Bradley Manning, the man besides Julian Assange, who's at the center of the WikiLeaks scandal. The book is called Private Bradley Manning, WikiLeaks, and the Biggest Exposure of Official Secrets in American History. And it's pretty fascinating stuff. And since we're going to be taking a little break until September from podcasting, I also want to take this chance to point out to readers that in the August 27th issue, I'll be publishing a big feature on the library e-lending environment, which, you know, as we've discussed here before, is kind of a mess. So be sure to check that out. And of course, I want to wish everybody a happy few last weeks of summers, and I look forward to connecting again in September.
Well, we look forward to having you back in September. Enjoy the vacation and keep up the good job there as being a dad for those two little kids. Thank you, Andrew Albanese, PW Features editor, who joins us every week for a look at the week's news ahead.
Thank you.
Well, now I want to turn to Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Thank you, Chris.
And what books have you brought with us this week?
Let's start right off with the fiction section. We've got a Q&A with Soho Press publisher Bronwyn Hruska about her debut novel, Accelerated. It's set inside the insular and insulated world of Manhattan's prep school elite. And she was inspired to write the book after her own son, a third grader in a private school, was evaluated for ADHD because he was having trouble settling down in class. She felt that he had a normal level of energy for an 8-year-old boy, but a doctor diagnosed him with ADHD and prescribed Ritalin. So this led Hruska, who's a journalist by trade, to uncover some pretty staggering statistics about the growing numbers of children being diagnosed and drugged. So she writes about that and talks with us a little bit about it. We also have reviews of Lenin's Kisses by Jan Lianki. This is a book about the residents of a forgotten mountaintop village who turn their physical handicaps into a circus act in order to attract tourism. It's a blistering satire, and the PW Review says that Lianki boldly plunges into the psychic gap between China's decades-old conditioned response to communist doctrine and its redefinition of itself as a capitalist power. And Jason Pergin's alter ego David Wong returns with a follow-up to his cult classic, John Dies at the End. This new book is called This Book is Full of Spiders. Seriously, dude, don't touch it. And John, very much alive, is back and joined by loyal dog Molly and freckle-faced, one-handed girl Amy. And together they battle an infestation of spider-like monsters that take control of their victims' bodies and wreak havoc on the town of Undisclosed. It's a phantasmagoria of horror and humor, just in time for fans of the predecessor. The film adaptation of John Dies at the End will be in theaters soon.
In mystery and thrillers, a number of titles with some really grisly storylines.
Yeah, we're getting very dark as fall and winter close in here. In the mystery and thriller section, we cover British crime reporter David Mark's outstanding first novel, The Dark Winter. This introduces Detective Sergeant Hector McAvoy, who's a complicated hero who well serves a sophisticated and disturbing plot. He looks into the murder of a 15-year-old girl stabbed on the altar of a church and the apparent suicide of the sole survivor of a 1968 collision at sea. Readers also learn a lot about the backstory of anatomist Gabriel Crowther in Imogen Robertson's Superior Third Historical, set in 18th century England, specifically 1751 London, where Crowther's brother is hanged for the stabbing murder of their father. And then in 1783 Cumberland, the discovery of an extra corpse in a tomb sets Crowther on a quest that may shed new light on his family's dark history. And we have a Q&A in the mystery section as well with Michael Robotham, author of Say You're Sorry, about a hunt for two kidnapped teenage girls. Speaking of violence in crime novels, he says, "I use my characters' reactions to illustrate the worst moments rather than letting readers witness them at first hand."
In science fiction, something about the invisible world.
Yeah, we cover Wonders of the Invisible World, which is a new collection from fabulous fantasist Patricia A. McKillop. She is just really one of the best authors writing fantasy today. She has tremendous range, and this collection really shows that. It goes all over the places, covering the terrifying and also the deeply poignant. And our reviewer says, "These modern myths are timely and timeless, retaining the cosmic resonance of folklore." And we also have a review of Three Parts Dead by Max Gladstone. This is a fascinating debut in which gods communicate directly with their followers and magic is practiced like law. So it stars a first-year associate craftswoman, who I guess would be the equivalent of a first-year associate attorney, and also a novice priest who are investigating the death of a god, hoping to resurrect him before his domain falls into disarray. And the PW review says that the combination of legal thriller and steam-powered fantasy may seem improbable, but Gladstone makes it work with an appealing cast and a setting that's rich with imaginative details.
And in romance, there's a character in the book we're going to talk about that it sounds like somebody we would read about in PW in some of the other sections.
Yeah, there's a really interesting trend going on in historical romance right now. A lot of historical romance has been in the Regency period, and now we're moving on more towards Victorian England, where women have a lot more independence and can do things like run businesses. This is Sherry Thomas's Tempting the Bride. It's a very strong conclusion to her most recent historical romance trilogy, and the heroine is a college-educated woman who owns a publishing company. So there's plenty of appeal there for readers who are in the industry, and she gets paired up with a Viscount who covers his affection for her with acerbic wisecracks. But then she suffers amnesia after an accident, and he takes the opportunity to woo her before she remembers that she despises him. So readers will share the Viscount's love for the self-possessed and impressively intelligent heroine.
In comics, what do we got?
In comics, we have an interesting title called Calling Dr. Laura by Nicole J. George. And the title kind of overstates the role of the famous radio psychologist who just makes a cameo. But the book is really about the author's struggle with her secretive family and the mystery of her father's identity. So as a child, Nicole believed her father had died when she was very young. And then she gets a palm reading as a birthday gift, and the results convince her that her biological father is still alive. So she has to go to her relatives to ask them about the truth about her father while hiding the fact that she is gay. And George's naive line art and sometimes labored visual storytelling are balanced by humor and incisive characterizations. However, our reviewer says this ambitious family narrative could have used a stronger editorial eye. And also in comics, we cover The Hypo by Noah Van Siver. It's a Fantagraphics title. This is a really wonderful, psychologically astute examination of what might be called Abraham Lincoln's lost years, 1837 to 1842. So this is when he had just started in the legislature, was trying to build a law practice, was kind of involved with this woman, Mary Todd, but then breaking it off. And really, during these years, Lincoln was gripped by a deep depression, and he calls it the hypo, short for hypochondriasis, but it's certainly a misnomer. It was very real, and Van Siver's heavily researched story and artwork are executed in a straightforward style, and his drawings have a kind of freehand looseness, and his use of language is very authentic. It has that real period sound. So PW's review says that this characterization of Lincoln is thoroughly human and identifiable, tracking a shadowy but formative period in the very uneven life of a man who shows little signs of becoming known as one of the greatest Americans. This is a thoroughly engaging graphic novel that seamlessly balances investigation and imagination.
Well, you know, I'm something of a Lincoln fan myself, Rose, and you've caught my attention with that title. I'm going to look into that. In nonfiction, we've got a book that sounds just right for a Bostonian who loves walking around downtown. It's called In the Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America. Tell us about that.
Walkable City is the new book from city planner and architectural designer Jeff Speck, who co-authored Suburban Nation, and he offers an informative and engaging look at what's gone awry in American zoning codes and road planning, and what can be done to re-engage the public with downtowns large and small. This is of interest to me personally. I was actually an urban studies student back in the day, and this is exactly what we were talking about. This has really been a topic of conversation for years among urban planners, is how to make downtowns really vibrant and attractive. But it's good to see that another strong overview of the topic is coming out, and hopefully it'll keep people talking about this very important subject. Our reviewer says that it's suitable for lay readers, but it's also a comprehensive title that would be a worthwhile reading for current architectural students, civil engineers, and local public servants. And readers will find themselves reevaluating their home landscapes and judging their own urban areas through Speck's lens. Also in nonfiction, another book for the architects, we have Georgia O'Keeffe and Her Houses by O'Keeffe scholar curators Barbara Bueller Lyons of the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum and Agapita Judy Lopez. They collect correspondence, architectural plans, photographs, present-day images, portraits of the artists, and reproductions of paintings to illustrate how O'Keeffe's two custom-designed houses in New Mexico combine native adobe architecture, her modernist aesthetic, and her love of the natural world. And they reveal how the properties fulfilled two different aspects of O'Keefe's independent nature, her competing desires for rugged solitude and domestic comfort.
In children's, we've got a title here about a penguin who got sort of shoved aside for a group of bears until he's returned to us today in 2012.
Yeah, this is Nothing Ever Happens at the South Pole by Stan and Jan Berenstain, who are obviously well known as the creators of the Berenstain Bears. This book, which is about a penguin looking for stories to write down, was actually supposed to be their second book. But after the Berenstain Bears took off, they decided the penguin could maybe take a break. But after Stan Berenstain died in 2005, Jan finished the book with her son. We also review a biography of sorts for One Times Square, which stands at the intersection of Broadway and 7th Avenue in New York City. And in this book, Joe McKendry chronicles the transformation of Times Square from a collection of livery stables and coal yards into the billboard-laden theater, advertising, and tourist destination it is today. We've also got a roundup of six picture book biographies featuring Johannes Gutenberg, Johnny Appleseed, Ben Franklin, and this is a great one that sounds really interesting to me. Molly Williams is an African-American woman who became America's first female firefighter in New York City in the early 1800s. That's a great topic for a biography, and I imagine a lot of kids will be interested in that as well. In fiction, we have reviews of several sequels. One Year in Coal Harbor is Polly Horvath's sequel to her 2001 book, Everything on a Waffle, which received a Newbery Honor. Potter Wookie, which is a sequel to Wonkenstein, in which a boy named Rob is visited by a creature who's a mashup of Harry Potter and Chewbacca from Star Wars. And we also have Princess Academy, Palace of Stone, which is a companion to Shannon Hale's Princess Academy book, which also received a Newbery Honor, as it happens. Adult author Sandra Dallas is also making her children's book debut, and we cover The Quilt Walk, about a girl's journal into the a girl's journey into the Colorado Territory with her family in 1864. And speaking of the late 1800s, in the children's nonfiction section, we review The Impossible Rescue, the true story of an amazing Arctic adventure. This is by Martin Sandler, and it follows a harrowing 1897 attempt to free 8 whaling ships locked in ice off the coast of Alaska. And finally, in the online annex, we have The Beautiful Music All Around Us, which is Stephen Wade's exhaustively researched excavation of the histories behind a baker's dozen of field recordings made by the Library of Congress in the 1930s and 40s. These recordings are included with the book on an audio CD, along with 17 other tracks. And you can listen along as the author explores the ebullient and sorrowful lives behind the music. There's a 12-year-old Mississippian, Ora Del Graham, singing Pull in the Skiff, Kelly Pace and prisoners of the Arkansas State Penitentiary doing a rendition of Rock Island Line. Wade profiles these and other vernacular builders while grappling with questions of culture and ownership, and by extension, what is ours individually and collectively. This is really a must-read for fans of blues and, of course, for ethnomusicologists. And finally, in the annex, we have another romance title. We cover Moonglow. This is the action-packed second historical paranormal, Kristen Callahan's Darkest London series. The first title was Firelight. And this installment tells the tale of Daisy Ellis Craigmore and Ian Ranulph, who's a werewolf living in exile. And it features historically accurate scenes as well as red-hot sensual interludes. So fans of the series and newcomers alike will revel in Callahan's newest offering. And that's it. There's no pick of the week this week. And now we get to relax and go on a bit of a summer vacation.
We do indeed. And if you're going to be doing some summer reading, can you tell us what might be in your bag?
Oh boy, am I going to be doing summer reading. Actually, I'm going away this weekend for a reading holiday. A friend of mine in England came up with this idea. I'm sure, like everybody else, you have this stack of books that you set aside to read later when you have time. So some friends and I have decided that this weekend is later. This is the time. We're going to take all those books, go off to a house upstate, and spend the entire weekend reading. I certainly have a lot to catch up on. I'm looking at a lot of the books that have received starred reviews. reviews in the science fiction and romance sections in PW this year, because we are only 2 months away from PW's Best of the Year feature, and that means I need to have read all the books that are good candidates so that I can make my decision as to what's good and what's worthy of that honor. And plus, I have some reading. It's just plain fun, though obviously there's nothing not fun about reading a bunch of books that got starred reviews in PW. So right now I'm reading Julie Garwood's Sweet Talk, which actually I think is going to be making its appearance on PW's bestseller list in Monday's issue. This is a romantic suspense novel that's got elements of law and finance. It actually matches up an IRS investigator and an FBI investigator as they go through Washington, D.C., uncovering embezzling and other crooked financial dealings. So that's just a little bit of a way to kick back and relax. Other than that, I have an entire motley assemblage of books to read, from hard science fiction and space opera to paranormal romance and everything in between. It's going to be a blast.
Well, it sounds like you're going to enjoy yourself. And, you know, I have to say, a PW Reviews editor who goes on vacation to read books, that's the definition of what the English would call a busman's holiday. Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor who blogs at Genreville, thanks as always for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.